Welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast for May 2009, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a champion for student voices. We recognize the essential role that free speech and a free press play in a democratic society, and the SPLC is committed to nurturing and protecting those freedoms for the next generation. For more information about the work of the Student Press Law Center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lomonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us today. In 1988, in the infamous Hazelwood versus Kollmeyer decision, the U.S. Supreme Court stripped away a good bit of the First Amendment shield that protected public high school newspapers from editorial meddling by school administrators. The perception was that administrators needed the leeway to protect students against material that was harmful, either because it was factually false or because it contained explicit sex or other material not suitable for young audiences. Well, that was the perception, but we've all come to realize now that the reality is very different. What we've seen in the 21 years since Hazelwood has been disastrous for high school journalism. At school after school, principals and superintendents too often abuse their positions of trust to remove harmless material from student media just because, in their view, the students' reporting is making the school look bad. Students have been told they can't publicize filthy and unsanitary bathrooms, gang violence on campus, inadequate library facilities, and other legitimate and newsworthy topics, all in the name of protecting the image of the school. The worst part is that dozens of administrators have put journalism teachers right in the crossfire, ordering them to muzzle any critical or controversial statements by their students, and sometimes firing or demoting them or transferring them if they don't comply. Well, since the Supreme Court has not seen fit to give student speech the protection it deserves, those who value uncensored student journalism have had to turn to their state legislatures for help. A state is always free to give its citizens more rights than the minimum recognized under the United States Constitution, and seven states have agreed to give student journalists the full benefit of the First Amendment that was taken away from them in the Hazelwood case. In these seven states, Arkansas, Colorado, California, Iowa, Kansas, Massachusetts, and Oregon, student publications are declared to be open forums for the expression of student views. Students still can't publish anything illegal. They can't libel people or threaten them or steal their copyrighted work. But as long as they stay within the bounds of the law and they don't incite disruption of school, students get to make their own decisions, what to print, what to broadcast, and what to post on the web. These laws seem to work extremely well. California has had a student press law on the books for 32 years and has had almost no lawsuits in those three decades because when you have a clear set of standards set by your state legislature, that eliminates the uncertainty of predicting and guessing how the federal courts might rule. Everybody understands the rules. Everybody, for the most part, obeys the rules. And as a result, California has terrific student journalism. In none of these states has there been any outbreak of libel or uncontrolled journalism run amok, and in fact, high schools almost never get sued for the content of their student publications. That's the reality, but getting that reality across to state legislatures can be terribly difficult when opponents of student rights engage in disinformation campaigns based on fear rather than facts. We have two veterans of the state legislative wars, Brian Schramm and Josh Moore, here as our guests, to give an inside look at what it's like to lead the charge for student rights in front of sometimes skeptical and hard-to-convince state legislatures. Brian Schramm is a journalism graduate student at the University of Missouri, but when he started working on free press legislation, he was an undergrad at Washington State University. Josh Moore is a student at Western Kentucky University, and he just finished his first legislative session trying to get an anti-Hazelwood bill through the Kentucky legislature. Josh and Brian, thank you for joining us. And let's start out with Brian. Brian Schramm, what was it that got you interested and involved and active in trying to get a student free press bill in Washington?
Well, you know, I would say, you know, there wasn't any big censorship issue that I was dealing with personally, but at the time, this was coming right on the heels of the fallout from the Hasti decision and all the potential ramifications that could be coming from that. So really, it was sort of a college mindset that I was coming into this with. And what I wanted to do was go to the school that I was attending at that time, at community college, and have a public forum policy adopted by the school to preempt any effect that that decision would have. We ran into some difficulty doing that, and I sort of got frustrated, and I knew a state representative, having interviewed him for a story previously, and so I called him up and kind of pitched the idea to him, and wasn't really expecting to hear anything back, but he was very receptive to the issue, and we kind of took it from there. But again, it wasn't some big personal issue that happened on my part. I guess it's just sort of been me being very passionate about this issue and seeing a need for this kind of legislation.
And Brian, just to jump in on your point, Brian referenced the Hasti decision. That is a decision from the Federal Appeals Court in Illinois, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Hasti is so far the only Federal Appeals Court decision which has said that the Hazelwood rule, the reduced level of First Amendment protection that applies in Hazelwood, might also apply to students at the college level. Up until Hasti, we all assumed that the Hazelwood rule was only about protecting young, vulnerable audiences and not the adult readers of college publications. So Hasti certainly threw a scare into a lot of people, and in fact, Hasti was the impetus for an eighth state, the state of Illinois, to pass a version of student free press rights, but Illinois' bill applies only to the college press. So it essentially, while it doesn't reverse Hazelwood, it reverses the impact of Hasti in Illinois. Josh, you had a different route to this. You actually had a very positive and favorable experience as a high school journalist, and I gather got concerned that not everybody shared that level of protection.
That's right. Actually, kind of like Brian, I didn't come from that experience, but actually the opposite, where as the founding editor of my high school paper, I had pretty much the freedom to do anything. Even the advisor didn't look at most of the issues before we went to print. But looking back, I can kind of remember wondering what would happen if something did happen and the principal wasn't happy with what we did. And I always kind of wondered in the back of my mind, would we lose that right? So just a few years later, I ended up in a conversation with the advisor of the newspaper here at Western Kentucky University. And we were just talking about some of the state laws that are out there that protect student rights. And I just thought it was really important and something that Kentucky should really strive for as well. So it just kind of went from there.
Well, Josh, you succeeded in getting a state representative to introduce a anti-Hazelwood bill in your legislature in the 2009 session. Tell us where that stands right now and what the outlook is for that in the future.
Okay. Well, like you said, we did have the bill filed for the 2009 session. It was referred to the Education Committee, but due to a variety of circumstances, for example, the state did a major overhaul of the testing system this session, so there wasn't very much time for a lot of other bills to get a hearing, and our bill was one of those that didn't get a chance to be heard. But we do have commitment from several members of the Education Committee that are really excited about the bill, so we're going to be working in the next year to get more people on board and hopefully get a hearing at least next session and hopefully go from there.
And Brian, you've been at this for several sessions in a row now. Tell us where things stand in Washington.
Well, I guess the first year we introduced this was, I guess January 2007. It doesn't seem like that long, but we got the bill passed in the State House that session after a fairly long and rather politically charged debate on the House floor that actually went well into the evening. I remember sitting in front of my computer, frustrated listening to that that night, but then it sort of stalled when we got over to the Senate side. We had a hearing on the bill, and the committee chair has been very supportive of us, but I think there's been some opposition in terms of the members of the committee, and so that's kind of where things stalled. And in the last two sessions, when we've tried again, we've kind of been stuck there as well, trying to get this bill out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and you know, the makeup, unfortunately, of the committee hasn't changed enough, I think, where we've seen enough support to get the thing passed. But certainly, you know, we're still going to keep at it. And you know, one thing I'm definitely confident of is, you know, because the arguments are on our side, this is going to happen eventually. I don't know when, but I'm definitely confident that it's going to happen, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Well, Brian, you mentioned the composition of the committee and opposition coming from some committee members. Explain to people, I think people listening to this may be thinking that giving students the benefit of the First Amendment and letting them publish without censorship is kind of a no-brainer, but where is the opposition coming from, and what are some of the arguments you're having to overcome?
Well, you know, obviously the biggest opposition to this, well, I shouldn't say obviously because it isn't obvious in my mind, but the greatest opposition has come from the school administrator organizations, the folks who represent superintendents and principals and school boards. And, you know, I think publicly what they're saying is that this is an issue of control over a state taxpayer-funded entity. You know, the old principal as the publisher argument that it's not a – in fact, we've had several lobbyists testify before committee rather sarcastically that these aren't student newspapers. These so-called student newspapers are actually school newspapers, and the school administration needs to exercise the same kind of quote-unquote responsibility for the content that a professional publisher does. You know, again, these administrator folks, they have paid lobbyists who work, at least in our state, full-time, obviously, on a variety of issues, and I think often it's advantageous for politicians to sort of stay in their good graces. And frankly, I think having opposition from those groups has really been the biggest deterrent to getting this passed, because they, you know, they tend to throw out these sort of scare tactics that, you know, if we allow students to do this, all sorts of bad things are going to happen. And as you mentioned in your introduction, nothing of the sort has happened in the other states that have passed these bills. But, you know, again, they continue to throw out these arguments that, that so many horrible things are going to happen, and unfortunately that resonates with people on the committee.
And Josh, did you have a similar experience and a similar type of opposition that you had to respond to in Kentucky? And maybe what were some of the ways that you tried to overcome that opposition?
I did, actually. A few of the times that we did hear from the education committee members that were opposed, you know, just said that they believe high school students weren't mature enough to make these kinds of decisions. They weren't to be trusted, kind of argument. But my argument against that is that the whole point of the First Amendment is to allow people, you know, to learn and to make mistakes. And if students aren't going to be allowed to make those mistakes while an advisor is there to kind of guide them along, then where are they going to learn those lessons if they're not learning them in college, in high school? And also another argument I came across, even from professional journalists, was that it allowed bad journalism to happen, quote unquote. But it, these student rights laws do nothing more than any professional journalist wouldn't be able to do. You know, it doesn't protect libel. It doesn't protect anything that invades privacy. So these student journalists are getting no extra privileges that a professional journalist wouldn't. They're only getting the advice of, you know, an advisor and a principal. So I see it as a perfect situation.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me that you get the trust and responsibility argument without, I think, considering that once a young person turns 16, or certainly in every state 17, that person's allowed to drive an automobile,
right,
which can place people's physical safety in danger. And certainly by the time a person turns 18, and many high school seniors are 18, that person,
right,
can get married, that person can sign contracts, that person can join the military, that person is old enough to vote. They're trusted,
right,
with all those responsibilities, and yet somehow we can't get it across to legislators that that person can be the editor of a 2,000 circulation newspaper.
Right. So where is that line that someone suddenly becomes adult enough to make those kinds of decisions?
Well, You mentioned the professional media and some questions raised even by people in the professional media. Josh, it seems to me like the professional media in Kentucky, by and large, lined up behind this legislation and was favorable toward it, correct?
Yes, definitely. We had, I can't even remember the number of papers endorsing the bill, and also several columnists across the state that wrote in favor of the bill. It was very overwhelming support in favor of the bill, and I didn't even expect nearly that support, but it was quite amazing.
And Brian, rather surprisingly, that has not necessarily been the experience in Washington, has it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say on the whole, if you were to look at media in the state of Washington overall, journalists were very supportive. I think the notable exception has been the Seattle Times, which has come out time and time again saying that this is a bad idea for a variety of reasons. And I think, you know, the most frustrating thing for me is I expect these sorts of arguments from school administrators. I mean, I don't agree with them, but I understand where they're coming from. You know, I don't have a lot of sympathy for professional journalists who just don't seem to get this. You know, and I'm not quite sure at the end of the day what they really think about this bill, but it was clear from the beginning that they had decided, their editorial board had decided to take a position that this is not something that we're going to support. And I think they've in fact gone out of their way to make that point time and time again, certainly as is their right. But it does become a very effective tool during committee hearings, for example, for a lobbyist on the other side of this issue to pull out a Seattle Times editorial and say, you know, here's what the real people, the professionals who really do journalism, here's what they say about this. And that can become a very effective lobbying tool.
So I'm guessing that both of you would agree that working with the professional media and in some cases trying to educate them and get them on your side early on would be a key if somebody were considering trying to launch one of these own campaigns in their own state.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
I would say, too, that, you know, I guess in a sense the professional media can be your best friend or your worst enemy on something like this, in the sense that a lot of the groups that represent professional journalists, you know, publishing associations, they have paid lobbyists, and that's a huge asset to have on your side. On the other hand, you know, like I mentioned, you know, if you're getting opposition from the professional media, I think that can be the sort of the kiss of death in a lot of cases because, well, the people who do this for a living don't even support this, so why should I as a state legislator?
Yeah, and that's one of the disappointing and surprising experiences that we have at the SPLC is that from time to time when a censorship controversy occurs in a community, the local media will actually weigh in favor of censorship. And it's normally using that same flawed analogy that the principal is the publisher or the principal is the editor-in-chief uh-huh. of the newspaper. But, of course, that ignores the fact that the principal in a public school is a representative of the government and is the person about whom the newspaper is writing. The perception, again, is that the principal may use his authority in a benign way to protect students against unsuitable content. But our experience, unfortunately, has been that principals, of course, use it to protect their own image and the image of the school, and that very often the principals themselves would benefit from having those decisions taken out of their hands so that when an angry school board member or an angry parent gets on the phone, the principal can simply point to the state law and say, I'm sorry, but this decision is out of my hands. The law ties my hands. Well, let me ask you, Josh, more after the experience of a year and the benefit of some hindsight. If somebody were to mm-hmm. come to you from another state and say, I'm thinking about launching a student-led campaign and trying to get my legislators and trying to get the important interest groups on board to have a student-free press bill, what would you tell them?
I would say expect a lot of people to be behind you right away. We talked about, you know, the overwhelming support from the media, but also just from high school students and college students. You know, I had numerous high school students contact me asking how they could help. I had people that I found out about months later that were going to their representative without even, you know, telling me about it. And that's awesome that people are taking the initiative to do those kinds of things. So I would say just make sure that you contact those high school students that are going to be affected by this. They're the ones that are most passionate about it. They're the ones that can get something done. And the more they're involved, the better it's going to be.
Brian, what about you? If someone were to come to you and say, I'm thinking about getting involved in this in my own state, I guess one thing you might tell them is pack a lunch. It's going to be a long ride.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Prepare for the long haul. I guess one of the things that if I were to, you know, come up with a tip sheet for folks would be, you know, start early, do your groundwork well ahead of time. I think, you know, in our experience in Washington, you know, considering the success that we had the first year compared to the subsequent years, I really think that first when you come out of the gate with it is really the most important point in a lot of ways because, you know, after that first year, people are dug in and they've decided where they are on this issue. And so it's often very difficult to get people, particularly politicians, to change their mind. And I would say, you know, it's, what is it, May now? You know, now is not a bad time if you're, you know, in the back of your mind thinking maybe this might be something to do in your state. You know, now's not a bad time to start thinking about it and having, you know, very preliminary conversations because these things can take time and building the coalition of supporters can take a lot of time and a lot of work. And that's the other thing, too, is if you're going to do this and you're serious about it, you know, I really think you got to at least have one person or a group of people who are really willing to fight for this and see it through and do what it takes. You know, I think having a sort of a coordinator or a central person, I think, you know, that's been Josh certainly, I think, in Kentucky, and that was me for a certain period of time in Washington. That's very helpful to have sort of a central clearinghouse for supporters and disseminating information, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's some terrific advice from two people who have put an awful lot of their own time and their own effort into something for the benefit of all students. And I want to thank you for both being with us today, Josh Moore and Brian Schramm. And thank you for listening to the Student Press Law Center podcast for May 2009. Check out our website at www.splc.org, and if you're a student journalist or an advisor with a question about your legal rights, or if you're interested in advice on starting your own student free press campaign in your home state, call our hotline at 703-807-1904, 703-807-1904, or email us at splc@splc.org. Thanks for joining us.